Welcome to the Speak Up Talk Radio Network. I am your hostess, Pat Rulo. We bring you hand-selected hosts, podcasts, and talk radio programming with listening options, 24/7 streaming, or listen on demand. We also feature one-on-one segments with important guests, people who have something to say that you need to hear. And if you are listening to today's interview and would like to be featured on the network, please visit speakuptalkradio.com for all of the details, or contact us at pr@speakuptalkradio.com. Today, I have a very important person with me with a life experience to tell that just may help others. He is author John Boyd. John is a tattooer, machinist, and a business owner from Pennsylvania. John grew up in a rough around the edges neighborhood called Croydon, which is just a few miles northeast of Philadelphia. Growing up poor and being the child of a single parent home, things were not easy. Looking to escape his hardships, at the age of 12, John started experimenting with illegal drugs. And this sent him down a spiral of self-destruction and crime that lasted almost 20 years. John survived a 15-year heroin and cocaine addiction, jail, homelessness, overdoses, and being pronounced clinically dead twice. Well, now, obviously, God had different plans, and John reached a point where he could no longer live this way. It was either get clean or die. After finally getting sober, getting married, and starting his first business, John decided he wanted to write a book. But he wanted it to be a book that would help people. After living through 20 years of hard drug use, crime, and dying twice and living to tell about it, John wrote the book titled, Is My Child on Drugs? If you suspect your child or loved one may be on drugs, his book could save their life. This book takes you into the mind of an addict, signs and symptoms of use, drug terminology, drug paraphernalia with full-color pictures. John covers the lies, cons, and scams a loved one might use to take advantage of family members. A whole chapter dedicated to each drug, including more recent and popular legal highs and research chemicals. He covers family enabling, rehab, halfway houses, prison, and law enforcement as well. This book is short, to the point, and very easy to follow. John says, who wants to read a novel when someone's life may be at stake? So if you have suspicions, this book will either confirm them or lay them to rest. And obviously, there is so much to learn here today. So welcome to the network, John.
Hello, Pat. How you doing?
Oh, I'm good. And I'm really thrilled to have you here. This is an extremely important topic for our time. So I knew the minute I learned about you that you and I had to speak. Not only did I want to cover your book for this network, but I also wanted to air our conversation on my radio network for young people called thoseradiokids.com, where we candidly tell our stories in an effort to help others who may be going through similar experiences. So I really do thank you for allowing me the opportunity to share you with our audience.
Yeah, and I thank you for having me.
And sadly, your story is not an isolated occurrence. So I think the best place to start is for you to share your life journey with us.
Okay, well, I grew up in Croydon, Pennsylvania, which is a few miles northeast of Philadelphia. Croydon was like a pretty much blue-collar, lower-income, white neighborhood. And, you know, there's a lot of hanging out on the corner. You know, a lot of people on welfare. my father was a drug user, and I came home from kindergarten. It was actually my first day of kindergarten. I came home from school, and my mother was crying, and I distinctly remember this like it happened yesterday. My mother said, your father left. And I, you know, being 6 years old, I kind of didn't quite understand what she meant about that. And, you know, I'm thinking, well, he left. When's he coming back? At dinner time? Or... but she said, no, he left and he's not coming back. And basically what he had done was he had left with a woman who my mother was nice enough to let stay with them because she'd fallen on hard times. And it turned out that hard times was a drug habit shared by her and my father. So basically what he did was he had picked up and left and moved to California. And I hadn't seen him for 13 years after that. We did reconnect later on. He just picked up and left. And I never wanted to blame my drug addiction or my lifestyle choice on my father. I mean, everybody chooses to do what they do, but it definitely did have an effect on the choices that I made. You know, I never wanted to blame it on him, but it definitely had, you know, had an impact on me. And I think it definitely contributed to some of the choices that I made. So, and you know, they do say that drug addiction may run in the family. It's like a genetic thing. I don't know how much I believe that, but, you know, my father definitely had a drug problem, and, you know, unfortunately I followed suit, you know, so, yeah, but, you know, it was a hard thing to deal with. And my mother, she's a saint. She's a good woman, and she never did drugs. She took very good care of me. And the bad thing about it was when my father left, my mother was pregnant with my brother. Yeah. And, you know, that made it even worse.
Yeah.
And, you know, my brother was born, and he, he grew up without a father as well, obviously, because my father left, and, you know, it was hard for us. So my mother went to nursing school, and, she became a nurse, and she graduated at the top of her class. And she had gotten a job at a nursing home, running a whole floor of a nursing home. And she had that job maybe about, probably about a month. And, I was with my friend, and we used to live in an apartment complex. And what we would do is we would jump over the fence of the swimming pool and swim in the swimming pool after the pool closed at nighttime. You know, you really weren't supposed to be in there, but we would hop the fence and swimming. And, my friend and I were swimming in the swimming pool when we heard this, skidding sound, like a car skidding and a big crash noise. And I looked at my friend and I said, that sounds like a drunk driver hitting a pole or something. Oh. You know, we kind of just shrugged it off and immediately went home after that. It was about around the end of our swim. And I went home and I mentioned to my mom's boyfriend at the time. I said, yeah, we just heard a really bad accident down the street. And my mom's boyfriend said, that's odd. I have a weird feeling. Your mother just left for work. So he left and he didn't come back for about a half hour. And I knew something was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So I, at the time when he left, I just gotten in the shower to take a shower to wash the chlorine off me. And, you know, I was in there for a little while. And when I came out, he still wasn't back. So I knew something was wrong. So I left and I ran down Newportville Road towards where I heard the accident. And my mother had gone in an accident.
Oh my God.
And a drunk driver had crossed the lane and hit her head on. And the engine from the car had come through the dashboard and pinned her up against the back seat. And I ran up to the car, and the police were there already, and they were using the jaws of life to get her out of the car. And I thought she was dead. She looked like she was dead. Her tongue was hanging out.
Oh.
You know, it just was a really, really bad thing to see. Luckily, she survived. You know, she made it. She almost died. She was in the hospital for a long time. But needless to say, because she suffered from head trauma, her nursing license was taken from her, and she couldn't be a nurse after that. So she's been on disability since then. So, you know, there's a couple of things that happened in my life that were pretty hard. So right around 12 years old, or actually I was 13 at the time, I was living up at upstate Pennsylvania with my grandparents. And my grandparents are a conservative family. They like to hunt fish. And my grandparents reloaded their own ammunition. They reloaded and made their own, you know, ammo to shoot through their guns. And there was a lot of neat things to play with up there, like gunpowder. And I took a can of gunpowder out of sheer boredom, because there really wasn't anybody around for me to play with. The nearest neighbor was about 2-3 miles down the road. And, you know, I took the can of gunpowder and I put it on the ground. And, you know, when you watch cartoons, you see like Yosemite Sam dump a pile of gunpowder on the ground and you lead a little trail to it. And what I was expecting was to happen was I was going to light the little trail that I, you know, made, and then I would have enough time to step away while that was burning, and then the pile at the end would explode. Well, unfortunately, I didn't really have a good grasp of the burn dynamics of smoke with gunpowder, and what had happened was when I lit down to light the pile, the whole entire pile flashed up and gave me third-degree burns on 14% of my body.
Oh, my God.
So I ended up in the hospital. Well, I was so burnt in the hospital that I was in isolation, and anybody that had to come into the hospital, my mother and my grandmother, they had to wear the full get-up, you know, the mask on the mouth and, you know, scrubs and all that stuff, because I was very highly susceptible to infection.
Right.
Well, every morning, the doctor, or the nurse, rather, would come in, and they would give me Demerol, which is a narcotic, and they would do this thing called debridement, where they would scrub my skin with a iodine sponge and a plastic brush. And basically what it did was it just removed the dead skin and the burnt skin so new skin could develop and, you know, cut down on the scarring. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you what, that button, you'd push that button and they would come down and give you a shot. And I was on that button every 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. So this was my first introduction to narcotics, opiate-based narcotics. So when I left the hospital at 13, I had a dope habit. And they didn't tell me that I was going to be going through drug withdrawals when I left the hospital. So when I left the hospital and went home, I didn't sleep for about 2 or 3 weeks. And I had been going through opiate withdrawal. And I really didn't know what was going on. You know what I mean? I said something to my grandmother. I said, I don't feel so good. I'm not sleeping. My legs are really uncomfortable. I got cramps in my stomach. I'm sneezing. You know, I just don't feel good. And she said, yeah, it's because you're coming off of the Demerol. And that was basically my first introduction to a dope habit. And I think that that set me up for the things that happened later in my life. And, you know, one of the things that I talk about in my book is a lot of kids these days are put on prescription drugs. I was doing some research online, and it blew me away how many kids are on prescription drugs, whether it be antidepressants. Yes. You know, they got ADHD and ADD now, and they're giving kids Adderall and Ritalin, which is basically methamphetamine. And the schools... I saw a story where the school was having trouble with a child that had been misbehaving, and the school had got in touch with the child's mother and said, hey, your kid's been misbehaving and we're having some problems with him, and we suggest that he goes to a psychiatrist. Well, for some reason, I don't know exactly how the laws work, but when the schools mandate these certain things, you kind of have to follow through with them, or there can be problems with CPS showing up at your house. Mm-hmm. So the woman took the kid to the doctor, and the doctor insisted that the woman put the kid on ADHD drugs, which was Adderall, which is methamphetamine salt. And of course the mother, you know, being the good mother that she is, thought this was preposterous and had enough sense in her head to say, I'm not putting my child on meth, on amphetamine. So she told the doctor in the school, I'm not doing this. Well, what happened was the school called CPS, and CPS came and took her kid. And put her kid in foster care, and then she went to try to get the kid out of foster care and took him without them knowing it, and she got put in jail.
Oh, my God.
So this is happening all over the country. Mm-hmm. You know, we're living in an age where doctors want to give you prescriptions for everything. You have an ailment, you know, or ADHD, which, me personally, I think ADHD has a lot to do with diet, kids' diets. There was a documentary on YouTube, and it's called The Medicated Child, and I suggest everybody watch it. It's a very, very good documentary about children who are on antipsychotics, antidepressants, and ADHD drugs. And the mother on the documentary, she's like, my child can't sit still. He's all over the place, and I don't understand why he acts this way. And the child is sitting at the table drinking a soda and eating a corn dog.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And she's like, he drinks a case of soda every day, but I don't know why he acts this way.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And
I
it
do.
Never occurs to doctors to change the child's diet as opposed to just filling them with all these drugs. So, but I'm digressing. So anyway, getting back to, you know, when I got burned in the hospital, I had been put on narcotics. So I already knew what it felt like to be high on opiates, and I really, really liked it. You know, like I said, I was pushing that button every 5 minutes for them to come down and give me the shot. So I had stayed up my grandma's because, you know, my mother had gotten in the accident. And the reason I was upstate with my grandparents because my mom was having a little bit of a hard time taking care of me since she was recovering from the accident. And I spent 2 years in upstate Pennsylvania with my grandparents. And my grandfather had Lou Gehrig's disease, which is amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. And he was on a lot of narcotics and medication, and I would raid my grandmother's medicine cabinet and steal Valiums and Percocets and all kinds of stuff, you know, while my grandfather was sick, because, you know, when I got out of the hospital, I had already had that introduction to opiates, and it did something to me, you know what I mean? And I was constantly, after that, I was just seeking that feeling, that high, to escape, you know, whatever kind of, you know, thoughts I was trying to get away from. You know what I mean? My mother getting in the accident, my father not being around, not having the father figure of my life.
Right.
You know, just these things that had led up to it. And by the time I moved back to Croydon, Pennsylvania, you know, I had already had a dope habit. I had already done intravenous opiates, which is basically heroin. It's basically the same thing. I had experience with Valiums. And I had experience with these drugs way before I had ever smoked marijuana or experimented with alcohol. So I kind of did things in reverse. You know, most kids, they start smoking marijuana, they start drinking, and then they move on to the harder stuff. Well, I kind of did it backwards, you know, and I think that had a lot to do with, you know, the things that had happened after that.
Right.
And, you know, having friends, peer pressure, being in school, you know, drug culture is really big these days than it was when I was in school. It was back in the 60s and 70s. And drugs have always been a part of, you know, society. And, you know, when you're hanging around in a rough neighborhood and you have a lot of friends there and you end up experimenting, not everybody does, but unfortunately I was in a position where, you know, I was around it. So off, you know, I was off to the races basically. I was drinking, doing acid, doing poorly in school. You know, I quit school, when I was in 10th grade. Luckily I got my GED after that. Then I, started taking the train down to Philadelphia. There's a train station in Croydon that takes you right down to Center City, Philadelphia. And throughout this time, I'd been playing bass guitar, and I was in a band, playing in a band down in Center City, Philadelphia. So I was always taking the train down there, and I had met a girl down there, and I started dating this girl, and she was older. And this is right around the time I was about 17. And I'd met this older girl, and I started hanging out with her, and she was also into doing drugs. And she, this is right around the time when she got introduced to heroin. And of course, me being around her, of course, I started doing it. And I started snorting it at first. And then, you know, within 2-3 weeks, I was hooked. And now, your body remembers. Once you have an opiate addiction, you cannot do opiates for 3, 4, 5 years. If you do opiates again 2-3 days in a row, you immediately have an opiate addiction all over again. It happens very, very quickly. It changes something in your brain. Once you have that habit, your body remembers it immediately, and you immediately go in back into that addiction mode. So I got addicted to heroin very, very easily and very quickly. Now, the thing you got to know about Philadelphia is North Philadelphia is pretty much the rough area of Philadelphia. North Philadelphia is the biggest open-air drug market in the country.
Mm.
Now, you don't need to know anybody to buy drugs in Philadelphia. You don't need to have anybody's phone number. You don't need to, you know the dealer or call somebody and have them meet you. Anybody can just pull up to a corner and you get served right through the car window like you would at McDonald's.
Wow.
And the whole entire neighborhood is in on the drug trade in some form or another. So the whole entire neighborhood, you probably have about, I don't know, maybe 10 square miles of neighborhood where everybody's selling drugs. And each corner sells crack, heroin, marijuana, PCP. It's like a one-stop shop. You can get everything you need right on one corner. And when you pull up to the corner, they yell out these names. You know, in Philadelphia, the heroin comes in a little wax paper bag, and it's got a stamp on it. And each corner has its own stamp. That's how you know what you're getting. You know, somebody will be, oh, Bart Simpson was really good today. So you know where the corner is where they sell Bart Simpson, or they'll have a stamp that says Mercedes or Demolition Man. It's usually something that's popular at the time, like a movie or a type of car or like a band. And, you know exactly what corner to go to. So in Philadelphia, it was very, very easy to get drugs. And this is pretty much where the downhill started happening. I got hooked on heroin. I couldn't hold down the job because I was strung out, you know. My mother ended up kicking me out of the house, so I had nowhere to live. And I ended up on the streets in Philadelphia. I was sleeping in a tent under a bridge. I was boosting, which is, you know, robbing stores. I would go into stores and steal stuff. I would steal compact discs. That was the big thing. When I was, you know, running and gunning in Philadelphia, I would go into CD stores and fill up my jacket sleeves with compact discs, and I would run out of the store, and then I had a guy at a used CD store that I would go sell my CDs at. And I would do that all day. And I was probably doing $300-$400 worth of heroin and cocaine a day. And, you know, I was being a scumbag, you know, I was just being a bad person. I was doing bad things, and I did a lot of bad things to my family. You know, I robbed my mom. I stole everything out of the house, her silverware. You know, I'd get a hold of her credit cards and drain the bank account. You know what I mean? It was just, it was really, really bad. And the thing about when you're doing drugs like that, you're, the whole time you're doing stuff like that, you know, you know what you're doing is bad. You know that you're not supposed to be doing that stuff, and you feel so, so bad about what you're doing. And any time that I ever stole anything from my mom, I would just wrestle with it for hours and hours. I can't do this. I shouldn't do this. I know this is wrong. I know this is going to hurt my mother. You know what I mean? But that physical addiction just gets the better of you. And the thing about heroin addiction is it's physical. When you're going through opiate withdrawal, you're every single kind of ailment you can imagine that could be happening to your body is happening at once. You're sneezing. Your eyes are watering. You got chills, but you're sweating at the same time. You got cramps in your stomach. You're nauseous. You have very bad diarrhea. Your muscles are extremely uncomfortable. So you can't sit still. You're like constantly talking and turning. But at the same time, you can't sit still. Your body is so fatigued that you don't want to move. Like if you have to go to the bathroom, it literally takes you 3 hours of psyching yourself up just to stand up to walk to the bathroom. That's how horrible it is. So of course, feeling like this, it takes precedent over your morals. And, you know, all you have to do is a little bit of heroin and it's going to take that feeling away. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And of course that, you know, it takes over your morals and you don't care, basically. Right. You know what I mean? And I saw a lot of people in Philadelphia, you know, being homeless and hanging out on the street. I saw a lot of people do a lot of bad things. I saw people sell themselves, you know, sexually for sexual favors. For drugs. Luckily, I had never reached that point, but I'll tell you, it came very, very close. I contemplated it, mm-hmm. you know, a bunch of times, but luckily I never had to go that far. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it'll take you to some very, very dark places. You know, I had guns pulled on me. Now, two of the worst things that happened to me when I was down there, and these are two of the things that caused me to kind of wake up and kind of come to my senses a little bit. I had overdosed a couple of times, and I don't know, you know, I don't know if anybody believes, some people believe it, some people don't, but an afterlife or, you know, things that can happen to you after you pass. But I had bought some heroin and cocaine, and I was driving my friend's car, and I drove down to North Philly to buy drugs during our lunch break. I had been working at a telemarketing place. And usually these were like the kind of jobs that I could hold down. You know, like these jobs where you kind of got cash at the end of the day so you could maintain your drug habit. So I was working at this telemarketing place, and my friend that I was working there with, was also a heroin addict. And I said, hey, you know, we're both dope sick. I got a little bit of money. Let me borrow your car and go down to North Philly, and I'll buy dope at lunchtime, and I'll get you a bag for letting me borrow your car. So I took his car and I drove down to North Philly. And when you're dope sick, you don't want to wait to get high. So basically what I did was I mixed up my shot of heroin and cocaine basically while I was driving, and I was shooting up at a red light. Well, I did my shot, and I overdosed. And I hit the gas and I crossed the lane and T-boned a Cadillac. And basically I overdosed, and the ambulance came and they took me to Episcopal Hospital, which is luckily only two blocks away from where I crashed the car. And, my heart stopped. I was clinically dead for a couple of minutes. And the crazy thing is, you know, you hear these stories about when people die and they say they, you know, they rise up above their body and they can see themselves. This is basically what happened to me. I was looking at myself, on the gurney, and I could hear what was going on around the, where I was laying in the gurney, and I could hear what the doctors and the nurses were saying. And I saw this light behind me, and I couldn't turn around. I kept trying to turn around to see what was behind me, but for some reason, I wasn't in a physical body where I, like, had a head and neck and I could physically turn my head. I was just kind of like a being, like, there. And I couldn't turn around to see what was behind me. And I specifically remember the doctor saying, do you want to call it or do you want to try it one more time? And basically, they were trying to decide whether they wanted to hit me with the paddles one more time to try to get my heart started again. Well, luckily, they did it one more time. And right when they did that, I got this feeling like, you know, when you go down a hill, like when you're on a roller coaster, and you go down, like, where the roller coaster is, and you get that feeling in your stomach, like it takes your breath away.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I immediately got that feeling, and all of a sudden, I took a big, deep breath in, and when I opened my eyes, I was sitting back, like, laying back on the gurney, like, where they were working on me.
Wow.
And the next day, the doctor came in, and I said, I saw you. I saw what you guys were saying. I said, you looked at the clock, and you called it, and then the other person standing there said, do you want to try it again? And you guys hit me again, and I woke up, and I said, I saw what you guys were doing. And he's like, yeah, that's common. That happens sometimes.
Wow.
And it really, really freaked me out.
Yes.
And it was enough to wake me up a little bit, but unfortunately, I still did drugs for a while after that, but this happened to me two times. And the last time that it happened was almost enough for me to want to stop using drugs.
Right.
But the final thing that made me realize that if I didn't stop, I was going to die. A friend of mine and me went down to North Philly, and we robbed a drug corner for a brick of heroin. Basically, I pulled up to the corner, and see the way, what I was telling you about North Philly, when you pull up to the corner, they serve you through the window. Well, I pulled up to the corner, and I asked them, I told them how much I wanted, and they said, pull around the block. Well, I pulled around the block, came back up, and I grabbed the guy by his shirt and pulled his head in the window. And I stuck a gun in his chest, and I said, drop it or I'm going to blow your head off. Basically, he dropped the brick in my lap, and went in North Philly, all the streets are like one-way streets. So they had the street blocked off down the block, and I had to drive back past the block that I just robbed to get out of the neighborhood. And when I drove back past the block, they shot the side of the car up, and I got shot. I got hit. And the bullet hit the door and split into two pieces. One of the pieces stayed in the door, and the other piece hit me in my pelvis. And then it bounced into my stomach and bounced around inside my stomach cavity a couple times. And I had, so since I had a whole bunch of heroin, I didn't go to the hospital. I was afraid to go to the hospital because I was involved in a crime and I didn't know what I was going to tell the police. Because of course, you know, when you get shot, they're going to call the cops. You know what I mean? And I was like, I don't know what I'm going to tell them. So I ended up doing a bunch of heroin for 2 days. And then I started getting really bad pains in my stomach, and my friend Rob was like, dude, you better go to the hospital. You know what I mean? You got shot. You're going to end up dying. Well, by the time I got to the hospital, my stomach was so septic. I had basically what it did was it tore open my stomach, and I had acids from my stomach leaking out into my stomach cavity, and it was causing a massive septic infection inside my stomach. So long story short, they operated, That was the last time that I died, and then that was it. That was the end for me, and I was like, I got to stop doing this. So I got into a halfway house, stopped getting high, stopped doing drugs, and I ended up relapsing one more time after that and getting on methadone. And I did methadone for a couple of years, and then finally was able to get off that and stop using drugs, but. You know, it was, this went on for about 20 years. You know what I mean? And the reason that I wanted to write the book was because, you know, a lot of these books that are out that people can buy if they suspect that their loved one might be using drugs, they're all written by doctors or psychiatrists. They're mostly written by people that don't really have any firsthand experience in using drugs. And I thought that by writing from a first person's account, that it would be a little bit more helpful for people. You know what I mean? I would be more apt to buy a book written by somebody that lived it, somebody who just kind of studied it from afar.
Absolutely.
You know what I'm saying?
I do, yeah.
I mean, does that make sense?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I want to tell you this because I think this is important to bring up. I recently interviewed a Harvard graduate physician and a rising star at the Boston University School of Medicine who wrote a book titled Free Refills. And he shared how he used and abused his power as a doctor to steal drugs from patients during home visits, how he would call in fake prescriptions. And I found this kind of scary. During dinner parties, he'd sweep the host's bedrooms and bathrooms for anything he could get his hands on, and he would trigger his pager so that he had a reason to excuse himself to take a call when what he was really doing was wandering around searching and stealing for drugs. So my point in saying this is that, you know, drug dependence knows no socioeconomic boundary, and it really behooves all of us to know the signs. And I'm really thrilled that you did. You said you digressed, but I thought it was extremely important when you talked about children on drugs and what's going on in our schools today and how the schools are even mandating that these children take this Ritalin and Adderall, and it sets them up for futures like this. So maybe just share some signs and symptoms that we should look for if we suspect that someone we care for may be using drugs.
Well, one of the main things, and I think it's a very, very telltale sign, is when children start doing poorly in school. That was one of the main things that happened to me. I started doing bad in school. I stopped paying attention because drugs became more important than my education. Another thing that I talk about in the book is a lot of times children will have friends that are, you know, they're good friends, they're good kids, the parents are good, and the parents feel good about the child hanging out with a certain person. But all of a sudden, your child will stop hanging out with that person and start hanging out with these other people that you get a sense that aren't so savory. That's another telltale sign, when your child switches its group that it starts hanging out with all of a sudden.
Mm-hmm.
You know, defiance, not listening, doing poorly in school, arguing, stealing is another main one, manipulating. In my book, I do a whole chapter on enabling. My mother enabled me when I was in my addiction. She would give me money because she didn't want me to be dope sick. You know, these are the things that parents will do because they don't want their child. No parent likes to see their child go through this. You know what I mean? And especially with heroin addiction, it's a physical withdrawal. And I've seen it time and time again where parents will give their children money simply because they don't want to see them go through withdrawals. And I know that sounds insane and crazy, but it happened.
Mm-hmm.
So I dedicated a whole chapter in my book to that. And, you know, one of the main things you got to remember when you're trying to get your kids off of drugs, you cannot enable them. That's the main thing. You got to have this, like, tough love approach, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
If they got to be kicked out of the house and be on the streets for a couple weeks, then you need to suck it up and do that, because sometimes that's the kind of thing that needs to happen for a child to realize, hey, this isn't the life for me, and I need to pull it together. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
And
it's time. I was gonna say it's time for
addiction is huge with kids these days, young kids.
Mm-hmm.
There's kids 12, 13, and 14 years old that are shooting heroin in this country right now. And the numbers are a lot higher than you will read on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at drug statistics through the FBI or through the FDA or anything, that the numbers are way lower than they are in reality. You know, back in the 80s and 90s, when I was a kid, if you knew somebody that was doing heroin, that was like a big deal.
Right.
You were like, whoa, that's pretty heavy duty. You know what I mean? Stay away from that person.
Yep.
But these days, it's right up there with smoking weed. It's very, very common, you know? And, you know, a lot of parents don't have any information to where they can really see the exact symptoms. You know, and I also cover just the physical symptoms, you know, when your kids are doing drugs, like how they act. You know, for instance, with heroin, it's got a very telltale sign of physical symptoms. The itching, you itch really bad. You scratch your face over and over, like itching your face. You know, the nodding, like closing the eyes and like kind of leaning over, like you're about to fall asleep. The raspy voice, your voice gets very raspy. Your pupils get constricted, they pin, they get very, very tiny. And, you know, these are all telltale signs, and these are a lot of, you know, things that doctors won't or psychiatrists won't write about in these books. You know what I mean? That you need to know, and things you need to, so you can spot, you know, these symptoms and adverse reactions from the drug.
Right.
You know, these are things that people miss a lot. So, you know, I spent a lot of time. Basically, what I did was I just broke my book down into each drug specifically, because each drug has its own set of, mm-hmm. you know, symptoms and reactions and behavior. You know what I mean? And I thought it was important to not lump them all into one kind of thing. I broke everything down. And another thing that's really big these days is these legal highs, like the K2 and the spice. And these are chemicals that are being made over in China and being shipped in, and basically they're not illegal because the FDA can't keep up with scheduling these drugs under the Illegal Substances Act. Mm-hmm. So basically the companies that are making them stay one step ahead of the DEA by just changing the molecule just a tiny bit, like changing the analog of the chemical ever so slightly to make it legal again. And they just keep doing that. And you know, it's really, really big these days, and some of it's even worse than, you know, heroin or cocaine. You know, people are ending up in the hospital overdosing on it. So,
John,
it's a really bad problem, you know, in this country and all over the world, actually.
Absolutely, and I'm so sorry that you had to go through such trauma in your life, but so happy that you were able to come out of it and be able to help others. And so your book is titled, Is My Child on Drugs? So as we begin to wrap up, tell us where folks can either learn more about you and where they can purchase your book.
Well, I have an email address. It's ismychildondrugs@gmail.com. I am available to come and speak at schools.
Okay.
Or, you know, if anybody would like to come have me come speak to a group of people, I am available to do that. And my book can be bought on Amazon. You just go on Amazon and do a search for Is My Child on Drugs?
Right.
And there's a reason why I named my book that. I thought it would be, you know, it's something I think that people would search. You know what I mean? If a parent was suspecting that their child might be on drugs,
yes.
they type in Is My Child on Drugs?
Exactly.
I figured that would be a good title because, you know what I mean? It's kind of like a, you know, a question, you know.
Right. It would be a Google search.
Yeah.
It's a Google search. How's the sushi bar going?
That's going good.
Good.
You know, I met my wife in New York City after I got sober, and she is the most amazing woman in the world. She really taught me how to be a man, basically, how to be a better man. You know, she taught me a lot about responsibility and honesty and how to treat people and how to work hard. And without her, you know, I wouldn't have what I have today. You know, it was because of her I was able to really pull it together and really get my act together. When you're doing drugs, you stop growing emotionally. So if you start doing drugs when you're 12 and 13 years old, basically you stop the process of learning how to be a social human being. You stop learning these social skills like honesty, you know, and like hardworking values and, you know, morals. And basically the drug takes over and basically stops you from mentally growing.
Right.
So because I started doing drugs at such an early age, I didn't learn how to be a human being, basically, or how to be a man. And my wife, you know, she's Japanese. She's from Japan. And, you know, she's a very, very hard worker, very honest, very decent, good human being, very trustworthy. And, you know, being with her really taught me how to treat people the correct way, how to be honest with people, how to be considerate, and how not to be selfish, and how to, you know, just how to be a decent human being, and, you know, how to work hard. And these are all things that I, you know, I didn't learn when I was growing up. Number one, because I didn't have a father. And number two, because I had been doing drugs the whole time. You know, I don't want to take anything away from what my, you know, what my mother did for me. She's a saint. She's an amazing woman. She did the best she could with my brother and I. But, you know, my wife really, really made me a better man. And, you know, without her, I wouldn't have what I have today, you know, as far as my businesses
right.
and, you know, my successful life and, you know, my happiness that I have. You know, without her, I wouldn't have any of that. And I love her very much. And I, you know, I just wanted to thank her for that.
Well, thank you for sharing that. I'm glad that you found someone who made sense to you in your life and could help you and just bless you. I'm so happy for you that you've come around and can help others now.
You know, I want people to know that I'm successful now doing this. I made it past all that and that I have a good life and, you know, a business and all, because I'm going to give people some hope at the end of the tunnel too, you know what I mean? And I think that's important.
So much more that we could talk about, I know. I think just by you sharing your story is just harrowing enough for people to stand up and pay attention and say, this can happen to your child. You don't want it to happen to them. So get a copy of your book, Is My Child on Drugs, by John Boyd. You can get it at Amazon. John, what a pleasure to meet you. Thank you for sharing you and your very personal story with us today.
Pat, I really appreciate you considering me for the show, and it was fun. Thank you.